wealth, when at the time of death all this will be stripped away from you, and you'll only have your sins to show for it. So this is the context. Now, there's a doubt that devotees and non-devotees often have about devotional service. And that is, you know, it's nice and everything, but is it really worth the investment of time? Because in life we're always investing in something in every moment. We choose how to apply our life energy, generally with the purpose of achieving some goal. So the question sometimes comes up, is this a worthwhile investment? For example, last night I was riding home on my bike. I'd just been doing some graphic design work for Aniruddha, and I was on my way home on the bike, and I went past Federation Square, and there's heaps of people milling about, a big projector projecting onto the side of the building, various movies and things, and they've got the lights set up across the river for the Moomba Festival, you know, flashing, and crowds of people all dressed up, and, you know, men and women arm in arm, children running around, enjoying. And I just got a call from Krishnagaraja saying that, can you please give class the next day, you know? So I was riding along and thinking, oh, I wonder what this is all about. Maybe I could go and have a look and enjoy, you know? You know, because that's what I might have done in the history in the past. And then I thought, you know, now I've got other services to do. I've got more pressing duties. And so I just rode on home. But, you know, one might, you know, the materialistic mind in the past might question, if the spiritual intelligence is not so strong, one might question that, why do I have to work so hard for Krishna when I could be out enjoying? For example, it takes me like 2.5 hours a day to chant my rounds. Be times that by 365 days a year, you end up with 730 hours every year, times so many years. Plus, you know, if you're coming to the morning program and you're reading and so many things, you're investing a lot of time into devotional service. And you're giving away all the results as well. That's the point of it, you're giving away the results. You know, people in the kitchen, working hard, chopping fruits, preparing boga to offer to Krishna. And it's done in a very nice, proper, careful way, and it takes a lot of time. And then it's put on the altar, and here you go, Krishna, the bell is rung, the prayers are said, and Krishna accepts the offering. That's the idea, Krishna accepts the offering. And then it's taken off, you wash all the plates, and you go to so much more effort doing things in a certain way with a certain protocol than you would do if you were just serving yourself. You know, many of us can remember, you just when you're hungry in material life, you just grab a loaf of bread that you just bought down at the shop, you whack it in the toaster, the toaster does all the work, and it pops up, and then you get over, you unscrew a bottle of peanut butter or something like that, you smear it on, and then you immediately put it in your mouth and chew. There's none of this offering or, you know, all sorts of fancy protocols that you have to go through. It's much more, it's quick, you know. And then you can get on with other things like studying for a qualification that will advance your economic development, working hard at your career, you know, or enjoying your senses. 2 hours a day, if you put that 2 hours into anything, it's said that actually if you invest a quarter of an hour a day, what to speak of 2 hours a day, in studying and practicing something, in a couple of years you'll be pretty expert at that. If you invest 2 hours a day, you can become quite extraordinary in a certain activity, if you really invest your mind in that. So sometimes the doubt arises, you know, is this the best use of my time, you know, in Krishna consciousness? You know, sometimes our parents might be questioning us. What are you doing? What are you doing? You know, you could be making money. Why are you investing so much time studying this book, these books that are just telling you that the material world's a waste of time? You could be making money for increase the wealth of the dynasty. Your friends are saying, what are you doing? You know, leading a life of discipline and performing all these activities that are taking up so much of your time. Uddhava, Bhakta Uddhava, he was saying the other day, you know, yeah, I've really got to just keep reflecting on what I'm doing, because, you know, sometimes I think, you know, I'm doing devotional service, serving at Crossways in so many places, I could be earning $1,000 a week, you know. I used to do that. I used to work hard and I used to earn $1,000, $1,500 a week. And now I'm living in the temple and, you know, I'm investing the same amount of time, but I'm not getting that money. Is it all worth it, you know? So this is the question. Sometimes the doubt arises like that. So the point is that at all stages of life, we're always investing our time, investing our energy in something. Everything's always a trade-off. When you invest in one thing, it means you have to take time away from another thing. We have 24 hours in the day, that's all. And many of us have to sleep. Some of that time, and varies to different degrees with people. We have limited time in a year and limited time in a lifetime. So we have to be, we have to think, what do I want to achieve? And therefore we have to think, how am I going to invest? We want to be an intelligent investor. So many self-help books, like there's one book called, a very famous book called Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, and it talks about how people can live a very effective life and achieve their goals. And the first point in the book is that most people live a reactive life. You know, they wake up in the morning and life throws a challenge at them or throws a problem at them, and they react, you know, they take a stance. And then the next moment something else is thrown at them, and then, oh, we need some money, we want to do this, so we have to... And they're just reacting to life situations, and in this way they go through their whole life. They never really planned anything. You know, they were at high school, and then they met one nice girl, and, you know, material nature ran its course, and then all of a sudden, you know, hopefully they're married first, but, you know, things happen, and then, oh, I better now... You know, now there's children coming. What are we going to do to pay for this? I better get a job. What type of job can I get? You know, just always on the back foot. Life is throwing things at them. And they're just responding as best they can. But the first principle in this book is that you should live proactively. That you should rather than just reacting to life, responding to whatever life throws at you, you should decide. You should take the ball in your own hands and run it. You should take the bull by the horns and make something of life. And one of the principles, the next principle, is that one should begin with the end in mind. One should think, what is it that I want to achieve in such and such amount of time? And ultimately, that time has to be, in this book, a lifetime. One of the suggestions is you think about, okay, you're on your deathbed, what, you know, you visualize that and think about what would I have liked to achieve in this life. Or you can imagine you're writing your own epitaph, you know, the inscription they put on the gravestone. Such and such person lived for so many years and this is, you know, a little blurb about their life. Imagine you're writing that for yourself. And then you think, okay, so what do I actually want that to say? What do I want that epitaph to say? And then you can work backwards and think, okay, now if I'm going to actually arrive at that achievement, then I better start investing now, daily, in order to achieve the goal. Because big goals, worthwhile goals, they don't take a couple of hours. They take lifetimes. Worthwhile things. So this is practice seeing the bigger picture. There was once there's a story actually, I think it comes from Taoism, Zen, and it illustrates this point nicely. There was once a merchant, or an aspiring young merchant, and he was traveling to a city, a big city, and there he was planning to sell his wares, make his fortune, perhaps get married, grow up, and enjoy the profit, enjoy the spoils, live happily ever after. And anyway, he was traveling with a company and he was bragging about his future and his great potential. And then anyway, they came to the end of the day and the journey was not complete, so they stayed at a tavern, an alehouse. And that night, the men, they got drunk, very drunk. And after getting very drunk, the man fell back and fell asleep and started to dream. And what was his dream? His dream was that he woke up the next day, he went to the city, he sold his wares, he was very successful. People liked what he had, he made good profit, and with that he bought more product. He sold it, he moved more units, made more and more income, gradually his business built up. You know, this is a Vaishya. Built up his business. And built up his empire. You know, he got married, had many kids, and everything was looking great. But then, at a certain point in his life, his senses started to break down, his health started to break down. His health got worse and worse, he couldn't enjoy anymore. He was lying there, eventually on his deathbed, and his family were squabbling over who was going to get his wealth, and things like that. And anyway, he was very disappointed and depressed at this point, and then suddenly he was gripped by an incredible fear, and he felt the bond between himself and his body breaking. And he was thinking, oh, but I wanted to do this, I wanted to do that. Hang on, I think you've made a mistake. You know, not me, maybe it's the person next door. Anyway, all these arguments, they didn't do anything. And then he suddenly woke up. And he was lying, but hungover in the alehouse. And then he thought, hang on. You know what? In my dream, I arrived at the end of life, and all my hard work, that amounted to nothing. Huh? What's the point of all that? So what did he do? Well, in this particular story, he went into the wilderness to pursue the Tao. But the principle is universal to all spiritual traditions, that reflecting on the transience of material life, the fact that all striving to achieve influence and wealth amounts to naught in the final analysis, this reflection on the futility of material existence is universal to all spiritual traditions, and it becomes the prime motivator to transcend and to work for something higher, something spiritual. Now this verse here that we're studying today, this is exactly that. Bakura is describing the experience of a man on his deathbed. What does the verse say? Abandoned by his so-called dependents. Because at the end of life, at a funeral, when somebody's just passed away, everybody comes along and kind of politely pays their respects. You know, and then when the funeral's over, they get on with life. They might get a call on their cell phone, and they go on, life goes on. And, sometimes even before that, we spoke about that the other day, the sad reality of retirement homes, and old people pushed into retirement homes, visited minimally by their families, seen as an inconvenience, unfortunate inconvenience. So this is abandoned by one's dependence, so-called dependence, ignorant of the actual goal of life. Like just living reactively with no real ultimate goal in mind, not really taking the time to reflect on what is the true nature of things, what is the true purpose of things. Ignorant of that. Indifferent to his real duty. Sometimes, oftentimes we can be so whimsical about right and wrong and things like that. Our real duty, and we just kind of live and, you know, ho-hum, let's hope for the best. Having failed to fulfill his purposes, you know, nobody's ever fully satisfied at the time of death. It's not like you arrive at the time of death and you go, yep, everything's tied up nicely now, I'm ready to go. No, everybody's always at the time of death. It's always, oh, hang on, I've had this to do, and I still have this dream and this unfulfilled desire. There's one story Prabhupada tells about a man who's very rich, and he said to the doctor, he was about to die. And he said to the doctor, look, I'll give you so many such and such lakhs of rupees, you know, if you can just give me a couple more years, you know, to live, because I've got a few more things to do, a few loose ends to tie up. And the doctor said, sorry. I am not the ultimate authority here. So, having failed to fulfill his purposes. And what? The foolish soul enters the blindness of hell, taking his sinful reactions with him. There's a saying, you know, you're born naked, you know, little baby comes out, he's not fully dressed, unless he's Vishnu. He comes out with conch and lotus flower and, you know, shining golden garments. No, most children, they come out naked or clothed in embryonic fluid. You know, wah, wah. With the umbilical cord attached. And you're born naked, you know, don't have any possessions, don't have any influence, don't have any fame, you know, don't have any reputation. Born naked. And then it said at the end you die naked, although most people are fully dressed when they die. But they've been dressed enough in the coffin, actually. You know, this special job where they dress the body up and they do special things to them. You know, release the gas so the corpse doesn't become bloated, and dress it up all nicely and sew everything up, sew all the holes up so nothing leaks out. So anyway, I die fully dressed, but the idea is you die, you can't take anything with you. You die naked. You die naked. When I leave, I'm going to leave this body behind. And I'm going to leave these clothes, I'm going to leave my bank balance, I'm going to leave my everything behind. And I'm going. I can't take any with me. So I'm born, you know, currently, according to past karma, every living being has an influence over a certain quota of material energy. That's awarded by Krishna, the Super Soul, according to past karma. One has a certain influence, you know. One gathers together a certain quantity of material energy and says, this is my dominion. But of course, at the end of life, you know, that's all finished. It returns to the greater pool, and the other conditioned souls, they struggle out and fight over it, you know. Actually, it's Krishna's energy. But anyway, yeah, you have to leave all that behind. But it's not true that you die completely naked, because you do take something with you, and that is your karma. What you have done in this life, that sets you up for your next life, your future. And these days especially, so many activities are sinful. The accumulation of wealth at the cost of the environment, of underprivileged peoples in different countries, you know, factory farming of animals, so much torture going on, people eating the meat, so many things. Even in a very pious, virtuous Vedic culture, it's understood that while the Grihastha is going about their daily duties, they're performing all sorts of sin. They're killing living entities just by sweeping the house. You know, housewives, you know, you can think about it. You're sweeping the house, you're accumulating sinful reactions, because as that broom flicks, it eviscerates so many microorganisms, they get splattered. If you light the fire to cook, then so many living entities are dying. You take one step, squelch. We can't see them, But living entities are everywhere. So it said sinful reaction is always coming. It's unavoidable. And why? Therefore, there has to be there's a certain ritual of atonement that the grihastha is supposed to perform. This is a materialistic understanding of things. Right? Because otherwise the sinful reaction might be too great and then one will have to suffer, taking his sinful actions with him. This is understood. Now, this concept of heaven and hell, you know, some people think, you know, heaven is, you know, the angels playing their harps and fluttering their wings and things like that, and hell is a big lake of fire, and you kind of, you know, you die and the trap door opens and you fall down into the lake of burn for eternity. Well, there's descriptions of things like that in the Srimad Bhagavatam. But also, you know, you can just see that there's so many conditions of life we could be born into. You see insects and so forth suffering intensely. You know, you even see in different parts of the human sphere, different countries are more nice materially than others. So, yeah, our current situation is according to our past karma, and our future situation will be according to our activities now. So, in any case, sometimes we can wonder, you know, what? Is this all worth it? You know, investing in Krishna consciousness, all this time on spiritual activities, and I've got nothing to show for it, materially. So, what we need to keep our determination is to develop our spiritual intelligence. We need to understand what is the material world, what is the reality here. And Krishna conscious philosophy equips us with the knowledge, with the thinking tools in order to evaluate our situation realistically. We have to become students of life, analyzing the nature of things. Now in Bhagavad Gita, there's a very brilliant verse. They're all brilliant. But this one particularly, it's very relevant to day-to-day life. And it's a good tool for looking at the nature of the material energy and sense gratification and having determination. The verse is text 22 from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 5. Yehi samsparsha jaboga dukha yoneva evate ajantavanta kunteya nateshu ramate buddha. That the intelligent person does not take part in the sources of misery, which are due to the due to contact with the material senses. O son of Kunti, such pleasures have a beginning and an end, and so the wise man does not delight in them. You know, so all these activities for economic development and so forth that the mind is constantly saying, get into it, come on, achieve, advance your economic situation, enjoy. Krishna is saying an intelligent person doesn't fret over those sort of things. Doesn't take pleasure, delight in bringing their senses into contact with desirable sense objects. Prabhupada comments, material sense pleasures are due to the contact of the material senses, which are all temporary because the body itself is temporary. A liberated soul is not interested in anything which is temporary. Knowing well the joys of transcendental pleasures, how can a liberated soul agree to enjoy false pleasure? So this is a basic meditation that anybody engaged in spiritual practice has to understand deeply in order to stay determined. So, the goal of Krishna consciousness, of all the activities we perform, is to develop full faith in Sri Krishna. There's a definition of faith that Lord Chaitanya gives in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Shraddha sabde, vishvasa kahe surida nishchoy, Krishna bhakti kale sava kama krita hui. That Shraddha is confident, firm faith that by rendering transcendental service to Krishna, one automatically performs all subsidiary activities. Such faith is favorable to the discharge of devotional service. So this is the kind of conviction we need, that by surrendering to, by developing devotion to Krishna, then everything is taken care of. Huh? There's one song written by a godbrother of mine about Krishna consciousness. It says, "Don't worry about what you eat or wear." That's from the Bible, actually. Jesus Christ says this in his Sermon on the Mount. He says, "Don't worry about what you eat or wear. Just surrender to the Lord everywhere. He is both within and without. You can know without a doubt by chanting his holy names. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare." So don't worry about one's personal maintenance. Jesus says in the Bible, see the birds and the bees in the field, who clothes them? Birds of paradise, they're garbed in such beautiful clothing. Jesus says, look at the flowers in the field. King Solomon, in all his glory, was not clothed as one of these flowers. Huh? So the idea is that, every living entity has been maintained by the Lord. Don't fret over that. It's not such a big deal. Huh? What should we do? Surrender to the Lord everywhere. Cultivate Krishna consciousness. Cultivate that relationship with the Supreme Being. And that's what all the activities in the temple are for. Huh? All the offerings, all the chanting, everything, it's to become Krishna consciousness. If you chant Krishna's name enough, you begin to become conscious of Krishna. If you cook offerings for Krishna, you become conscious of Krishna. This is what the lifestyle is all about. And to become not so concerned for oneself, understanding that if I serve Krishna, all my personal needs will be taken care of. He is the Lord. Of course He will take care. So this is the definition of faith. And that takes time. It's Krishna's crowning call in Bhagavad Gita, Sama Dharma and Prakshaja. Abandon all varieties of religion, everything that you think you should be doing, and simply surrender. I will protect you, do not fear. All the sins, I'll protect you, I'll look after you. This is what he says. That takes time, though. That has to be cultivated gradually in a balanced way. We have to approach Krishna consciousness with balance. Sometimes Indian boys, I meet them on the tram coming home from the city where we have our preaching center, and they'll sit there and they go, "Oh, Hari Prabhu," and I said, and we start talking, and they'll reveal that they're students studying, or they're working a job, and they say to me, "Oh, I could never do what you're doing, fully surrendered to Krishna, living in the ashram, not worried about your wealth, not worried about your occupation. You are such a great soul." They say like this, and I'm like, actually, it's not the absolute truth about the situation. My spiritual master said, do it for a few years, and then we'll see after that. And it's valuable, it's good for any devotee to have some period in their life where they're fully engaged. Fully engaged. Because what that does is gives one a depth of taste for devotional service, that it changes one's priorities in life. One thinks, I'm so satisfied just by serving Krishna. When it comes, because I may have various desires in my heart, I may have certain duties to my family. But if one has a deep taste for serving Krishna, that comes from experience, if one has that taste, then one will resist, one will be reluctant to over-endeavor in the material sphere. Because one will not want to compromise one's devotional service. One will want to organize one's life so they get by materially, just like Hridu Ananda Das Goswami says here, that the devotees, they don't endeavor to build a big economic empire. They don't necessarily endeavor for massive families or large properties. So much they don't endeavor so much for material achievements. They're not so much interested in that. They realize that these things will not ultimately fulfill me. What they endeavor for is devotional service. And if one has some experience, especially in the early years, and one has some experience and deep taste and flavor, then that will carry one through. One will be less inclined to compromise that at any stage by over-endeavor. Now, Ravindra Swarup, he talks about the old days when the devotees used to preach. And their idea of preaching was you get some young Western student or hippie, and you sit them down and you say, "What are you doing with your life? It's all a waste of time. You know, can't you see? It's a waste of time because of this, this, and this. Are you studying? Just drop out. What you should do is shave your head, move up, and move in the temple, and go out on Sankirtan. Brahmacharya, Sri Krishna, Sankirtan ki." You know, just forget it all. Drop out. Dive into full-time devotional service. The rest is maya. You know, and this is so much their focus that they said, Ravindra Swarup was saying, you know, there'd be a temple room full of congregational members, you know, Indian householders or devotees who, you know, people who are immune to shaving their head and moving in the temple, and they'd be thinking, there's nobody to preach to. Because there's no young, you know, men and women that you can just say, give it all up and join us and just full-time for Prabhupada. You know, so they were saying that this was their idea of preaching in the past. But what often happened in those days is they'd tell somebody, you know, yeah, just drop out and give up your education in the slaughterhouse for the young. That's what Prabhupada referred to university as sometimes, you know, teaching material knowledge so you can learn how to be a dog, begging at the lotus feet of your employer, please give me a wage. They said, yeah, so they just said, just give all that up. So they'd do that, you know, this young person would do that and move in the temple and go out on Sankirtan for some time. And then after some years, or whatever, things would come up in the heart. Oh, you know, I'd really like to get married. I'd really like to have a family. And, you know, desires come up in the heart. And then suddenly, yeah, I'd like to have a family. So then they say, no, that's all Maya. Just go ahead. No, I really want to do it, you know. And it became apparent that everybody's not going to remain a single powerhouse brahmachari or brahmacharini. That became obvious. And lots more and more people started to get married and moving out of the temple. And then they'd go to pursue a career. But, of course, and by that stage they were bitter. They were thinking, you told me to drop out of university. You told me to give up my job to do this, to do that. And now I can only get bad jobs. I don't have much economic leverage. And there's a bit of bitterness that went on. So these days, you know, it's not that... The preaching is not so much in that mood. It's more like, yeah, you know, you're studying, that's good. Maybe you complete that because in the future you might want to get a job, have a family, whatever. And also, if you've got a good job, then you can also help support the Krishna conscious movement with that. But maybe, you know, if you've got the capacity in your life, you're young and you're unencumbered, maybe do some full-time service in the temple for some years and then you can go back to your studies or your occupation or whatever. A bit more balanced. Because what we have to do is see our life as a whole. It says in Bhagavad Gita that the yogi, he acts for purification. He is set on the goal, I want to be a pure devotee. One day I want to have no desires in my heart that distract me from devotional service. This is my goal. But I have to be practical about attaining that goal. I have desires that I may need to work through. I have duties that I need to perform. Therefore I'm going to cultivate Krishna consciousness in a balanced, organic way, and work with my situation, use it to serve Krishna. At the same time, work through my desires, gradually by reflection, observation and reflection, and by the cultivation of knowledge and a higher taste, I can gradually, these things will dissolve in my heart naturally. I won't feel any bitterness or stress, you know, and eventually I'll arrive at that point where I can fully surrender. You know, I can 24 hours a day, I just meditate on Krishna while I'm doing devotional service. And whatever capacity, it doesn't matter, you know, whether you're a working man or woman, huh? Or you're a sannyasi. Prabhupada said, you know, to some of his early disciples who would work and then give the income to the temple and, you know, come to all the programs and stuff, he said, you are better than a sannyasi. Don't worry about having to change ashram. Huh? Because it's the consciousness, the meditation. This is Krishna's energy, I'm Krishna's servant. Let me use my skills, my propensities to serve Krishna. So this is the balanced approach. So just to conclude, the idea is that self-realization is worth investing in. There is fundamental flaws with material existence that make it a little bit futile to invest one's hopes and dreams in the material energy. There's definite flaws there that should be reflected on. Therefore, one should be confident and happy that by cultivating devotional service, one is making a worthwhile investment of his or her time. If we develop a relationship with Krishna, that relationship will fill us up wherever we are. Birth after birth, if we remain in the material world in some capacity of service, or in the spiritual world, wherever we are, we can never be outside the energies of the Lord. And if we're conscious of the Lord then, and have a loving relationship with the Lord, then that will fill us up wherever we are, in whatever capacity of life. That's the worst thing, is to forget your Krishna consciousness and lose association with devotees. Worst thing is not to die. That happens to everyone. The worst thing is to lose association with devotees or forget your Krishna consciousness. So to cultivate Krishna consciousness is very worthwhile. And we'll just finish with a little reading from Chaitanya Charitamrita. We're going to read about the creeper of devotional service, the Bhakti Lata Beej. We can have a little... a poetic insight into the nature of the cultivation of Krishna consciousness. Lord Chaitanya says, he's speaking to Rupa Goswami, instructing him in devotional service. He says, according to their karma, all living entities are wandering throughout the entire universe. Some of them have been elevated to the upper planetary systems. That's the person who dies with good karma. Some are going down to the lower planetary systems, like the example that Akuru is giving, taking with him only his sinful reactions. He's going down to the lower planetary systems. Out of many millions of wandering living entities, one who is very fortunate gets an opportunity to associate with a bona fide spiritual master. And all of us have had that, directly or indirectly, with Srila Prabhupada, either through his books, or personally, some of us are very fortunate. So, one who is very fortunate gets the opportunity to associate with a bona fide spiritual master by the grace of Krishna. By the mercy of both Krishna and the spiritual master, such a person receives the seed of the creeper of devotional service. When a person receives the seed of devotional service, he should take care of it by becoming a gardener and sowing the seed within the heart. If he waters the seed gradually by the process of Shravana and Kirtana, hearing and chanting, the seed will begin to sprout. So the whole lifestyle of Krishna consciousness is simply pouring water on that seed, so it will sprout and grow. As one waters the Bhakti Lata beads, the seed sprouts, and the creeper gradually increases to the point where it penetrates the walls of this universe and goes beyond the Viraja river between the spiritual world and the material world. It attains Brahma Loka, the Brahman effulgence, and penetrating through that stratum, it reaches the spiritual sky and the spiritual planet of Goloka Vrindavan. So this is the devotion, transcending, by dint of devotional service, one has transcended the material energy, the material world, and now one's mind dwells in the spiritual world. Being situated in one's heart, and been watered by Shravana Kirtana, the bhakti creeper grows more and more, so it's still growing. In this way, it attains the shelter of the desired tree of the lotus feet of Krishna, who is eternally situated in the planet known as Goloka Vrindavan, in the topmost region of the spiritual sky. The creeper gradually expands in the Goloka Vrindavan planet, where it produces the fruit of love for Krishna. Although remaining in the material world, the gardener regularly sprinkles the creeper with the water of hearing and chanting. If a devotee commits an offense at the lotus feet of a Vaishnava while cultivating the creeper of devotional service in the material world, his offense is compared to a mad elephant that uproots the creeper and breaks it. In this way, the leaves of the creeper are dried up. The gardener must defend the creeper by fencing it in all around so the powerful elephant of offenses may not enter. Sometimes unwanted creepers, such as the creepers of desire for material enjoyment and liberation from the material world, grow along with the creeper of devotional service. So we all experience this, you know, different desires come up. Because we're watering the garden, also the weeds will grow as well. The varieties of unwanted creepers are unlimited. Some unnecessary creepers growing with the bhakti creeper are the creepers of behavior unacceptable for those trying to attain perfection. Diplomatic behavior, animal killing, mundane profiteering, and mundane adoration and mundane importance. All these are unwanted creepers. If one does not distinguish between the bhakti lata creeper and the other creepers, the sprinkling of water is misused and the other creepers are nourished while the bhakti lata creeper is curtailed. This is why we need spiritual intelligence to reflect on one's condition and one's internal world and just analyze honest self-appraisal and see what am I cultivating here in terms of desires. As soon as an intelligent devotee sees an unwanted creeper growing beside the original creeper, he must cut it down instantly. Then the real creeper of Bhakti Lata Beej grows nicely, returns home back to Godhead and seeks shelter under the lotus feet of Krishna. When the fruit of devotional service becomes ripe and falls down, the gardener tastes the fruit and thus takes advantage of the creeper and reaches the desired tree of the lotus feet of Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan. There the devotee serves the lotus feet of the Lord, which is compared to a wish-fulfilling tree. With great bliss he tastes the juice of the fruit of love and becomes eternally happy. So this is the nature of our Krishna conscious investment. And just to finish up, Srila Prabhupada, he points out, you know, that you've had so many lives struggling in the material world. He said, you have nothing to show for it ultimately except your karma. Why struggle in this life again? He said, even if your faith is not full, just why not? What have you got to lose? Just give this one life to Krishna. That's what he said. Right. Compelling concept. Just give this one life to Krishna. What have you got to lose? And my spiritual master, often when preaching to young people, he'll say, "You a gambling man? Are you a gambling woman? Huh? Here are the odds. You know, look at the material energy. This is its nature. This is the promise of Krishna consciousness. You may not believe it fully, so you might have to gamble a little bit. You know, take your chances. Try chanting Hare Krishna. Try serving the lotus feet of the Lord. But if you lose, what have you got to lose? Huh? One life amongst millions of lives, you know, leaving footsteps in the sand of the material world just to be washed away with time. If you win, you win big. So if you're going to gamble, gamble on Krishna. So thank you so much for listening attentively. Is there any questions or comments on these points? Yes,
Prabhupada. Prabhupada asked a question in the book of India that why would the rate of salt settle for such a moment? Why did
you? Why, yeah, the liberated soul won't. That's his point. Yeah, that's what he says. He says, how, you know, it's a rhetorical question, basically saying, here's what's the quote. A liberated soul is not interested in anything which is temporary. Knowing well the joys of transcendental pleasures, how can the liberated soul agree to joy of false pleasure? In the Padma Purana, it is said, Ramate yogino nante sat yan nande chid atmani ati rama panane param brahma vidyate. The mystics derive unlimited transcendental pleasure from the absolute truth, and therefore the supreme absolute truth, the personality of Godhead, is also known as Rama. And then he quotes from Bhagavatam, "My dear sons, there is no reason to labor hard for sense pleasure while in this human form of life. Such pleasures are available to the stool eaters, the hogs. Rather, you should undergo penances in this life by which your existence will be purified, and as a result, you'll be able to enjoy unlimited transcendental bliss. Therefore, those who are true yogis or learned transcendentalists are not attracted by sense pleasures, which are the cause of continuous material existence. The more one is addicted to material pleasures, the more one is attracted by material miseries." Yeah, so that's his point then. An intelligent person does not take part in the sources of miseries. Okay?
My question was more that if we were the ready souls,
yeah.
Why would we
settle? Oh, the big question. Yeah, well that's, I'm not really qualified to answer that question exactly. Yeah, the question of the four, it's a very interesting one. Yeah, it's a whole other topic for advanced devotee to address. Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you so much. Grantraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki.